Hello, everyone. Thank you for joining us on In the Metal. Welcome, and we look forward to treating you tonight to a look at another fantastic independent watchmaker, independent brand, and which uses some very amazing techniques and materials that date back over 1,000 years. So it's a material that's forged from, as I said, of a social media post on the in the hell fire heat of a bladesmith's furnace. And so we're looking forward to finding out a little bit about the amazing Damascus steel and how Gustafsson and Schrogen from Linköping in Sweden use it to create some of the most beautiful watches out there you'll find today. So, without any further ado, I would like to reach across the Atlantic pond and see if my friend Dan Spitz is there. Hey, Dan.
Hey, Johnny, how you doing over there?
All good, all good.
You're looking like you got a haircut.
Do you think so, my friend?
Either that or the hellfire got you, bro.
Well, I actually got my hair cut with a brazier, you know, so...
Hellfire, it sounds more like some of the thrash metal stuff I used to be around.
It freaking looks like it, man.
Hellfire.
Whenever you guys are talking, I'm off to get myself a cap.
There's a new thrash metal band from Sweden called Hellfire.
Hellfire, let me tell you, I bet you there is, like, you know.
Yeah, so, I'm excited for today.
Sweden, they like their heavy metal and they like it dark over there, like, you know. So,
very brutal, man. Brutal.
Isn't it? Yeah.
Always had killer shows in Sweden. And I think in the early days, like in the early 80s when we toured there, we actually stayed in some, like, lady's house upstairs. Like, not even a hotel. We couldn't afford that. And we had to get out and get our own eggs in her chicken coop. I remember that. That was Sweden. I remember that.
Wow. Wow. Some stories. But no.
Touring stories.
An amazing company.
No, I'm really excited because Damascus is a very exciting material. And it's hard to machine. And it's a... Very few people around the globe are starting to use it, and it's actually trying to find its way into the more mainstream dudes. Of course, the independents have been founded first figured out how to machine this and how to do everything. We're going to hear more about that with Patrick.
And I have some amazing photographs lined up to see it. It's a material, as you say, yes, we're starting to see it in different brands and things like that. But I'll tell you what, the first place I ever saw it was on a GOS Gustafsson and Schrogen piece. And I think it's about time we...
Wait, before we start here and introduce Patrick, we just want to say that John has been working and slave driving himself, making our own website for In the Metal, and it's launched. So
it's what? It's launched? You're kidding me.
It is launched. There you go. So if you all go over there and have a look and tell us all everything that's wrong with the website and direct all that to just Johnny and not me, and everything that's right and you love about it, direct that to me.
That's fair enough, yeah. That's the deal I cut. I am a good negotiator, but it all went to hell, so it did, you know.
Look, we're both just here, me and Johnny. You know, this all started during the pandemic, and we want to just help watchmaking and independent watchmaking in general.
Sure.
And Johnny is the master at what he does with his gifts. Hard. And this is, you know, a real extension of his arm and a beautiful website. So have a look and gain some knowledge.
Definitely. Yeah, everybody, inthemetalpodcast.com. Even though we haven't got the podcast end of it sorted out, that's the next step that Dan has instructed me to do.
Yeah, I always do it ass backwards, bro.
Not a problem. Well, listen, you know, if people, anybody, if you like, go and have a look at inthemetalpodcast.com. We'll flash this up again later on. Let us know what you think. Only if we have nice things to say. If you haven't got nice things to say, send us a letter to Johnny in Ireland. Okay.
Let's bring Patrick on, because I really want to talk. He's like the master of finishing, and especially this stuff too. And I know he's done classes in Dubai and all kinds of stuff. So we really want to hear everything he has to say.
Totally. So without any further ado, Linköping in Sweden. Hello, Patrick.
Hi. What an introduction. Hiya, Dan. Hiya, Johnny. How are you?
Excellent. Excellent. It's fantastic, Patrick, to welcome you onto In the Metal. I have wanted for ages to get talking to you because I discovered independent watchmaking back around about 2007, 2008, and among the first brands that I came into physical contact was, I think, in Salon QP or maybe even before that. And it was these amazing watches that were spectacular in their whole aesthetic. They were a lot like anything I had seen before, Dan. These were completely unconventional. And the reason for that was this sorcery that is...
Viking. Use Viking. It's better. Swedish Viking.
Yeah. Let me tell you, it was there.
Right. The first ones we made were really, really extreme. We have filed a bit of the edges away, but still we are kind of unique in the watch case.
Still unique, and you know, there's only one original. You know, and so you do see them. Other people experimenting with it you know, but it's like, you know, you've got another guy there, a great friend of mine in Stockholm, who is James Thompson, and he kind of has the same kind of situation where he's making these amazing rings. Other people are copying the ass out of it. You know, but they're always inferior. The original is always the best. You Joe, you're the ones that have put your heart, soul, your passion into learning about
I have a way to describe how to use something you don't really understand it, and now it's the perfect time to use that because. Using a material that you're not familiar with is kind of the same thing as buying an instrument. Then, like if someone buys a guitar and tries, he wants to have the same sound as you, and he buys your equipment and picks it up, and it's not possible. So it's the same thing now with people using Damascus steel without really understanding.
You know, now that you say that, it really does make sense. And what you just said about artists and musicians, that absolutely holds true. Being at the level I was and being around other people such as myself, I got to plug into their stuff. So, and that theory is definitely proven. You know, if I plug into Van Halen's amp, I'm not going to and play his song, and I can play it. Right.
Yeah.
Obviously, it's not even close. You know, it's what's in us. You know, and I think what you just said about the Damascus is true, because I know my really good friend Joshua in Australia. They're using it, and it's found their way into their way. And it's a unique material. So I want to know a little bit more. Let the people know, because I'm sure a lot of people here are going, what the hell is he talking about? It's not brass. It's not, you know, German silver. It's not rhodium plated brass. It's not gold plated brass. It's not specialized brass like I'm using here. It's not steel. So if you can tell us the connection, your little Swedish Viking connection by the lake there.
Yeah.
And you guys went out with your shovels and went by the Swedish lake with other Vikings and dug this rock up from underneath the lake. If you could tell us, I'm kidding, of how it really started. It's probably a close story, but if you could tell us how it started. Well,
I can tell you a bit about how GOS started. Because the G in GOS is Johan Gustafsson. He is a brilliant bladesmith. So that's one advantage we have already, because we have an expert on the material in-house. And we can also produce the material in-house. So we can make, and the material is I usually explain it by saying pattern welded. Damascus steel is like a generic term that everyone uses, but saying pattern welded is maybe makes it a bit easier to understand. But what you do, but even what the Vikings did 1,000 years ago.
I knew it. Actually,
yeah. We go way back.
There's always Vikings in there somewhere.
Yeah. Viking swords were superior, and they were able to make superior swords because they mixed two materials, two different steel types, and they made it hybrid material, hybrid metal back then, and they were focusing on the properties of the steel, but then it became beautiful as well. That was a side effect, but the way it was forged meant it could be, the swords could be made very, very long and flexible. So they had a superior reach and also were able to sharpen them to extreme sharpness.
Their effectiveness, because this, yeah. Tell us about this, Patrick. This is an actual ancient Viking sword.
Yeah, this is a genuine Viking sword that was dug up outside Uppsala, north of Stockholm in Sweden. And you can see the pattern welding in the core of the sword. And the way it was forged meant it was made very thin. So the sword was flexible. So you could even throw it like on the side of a shield and hit the opponent. So it was a very, very impressive weapon.
Yeah, it wouldn't break.
Yeah.
Yeah. And because I can tell you how effective it was. It's so effective, Patrick, that where I live is called Carlingford. And you know how it got its name? Carlingfjord. Carlingfjord.
Fjord.
So it's actually a little Irish village about 10 miles from me. I can see it from here across the water. And it's called Carlingford. And the whole area is called Carlingford Lock. And it's beautiful in that on the east coast of Ireland. It's about 100 kilometers north of Dublin, up the east coast. Yeah. And it's beautiful. But the town is named quite literally because of your descendants, mister, who came over here. And they called some hassle, let me tell you. So,
Viking might.
Let me tell you, you're lucky you're over in the States, man. I didn't get that far. Or, no. But,
I can only say all this stuff because I have a lot of friends from Sweden. I used to play with a drummer from Yngwie Malmsteen's band. From Sweden, so I know it's Viking bite, you know. everything stems back to Viking. You could be eating eggs in the morning and somehow there's a Viking story.
Yeah, but for me and Johan, it goes deeper than the steel, actually, because we both admire the artisans, the Viking artisans. They were able to make incredible pieces of jewelry, belts, buckles, anything, and we grew up admiring the handcraft from these guys.
So how did you two guys meet and then decide to actually like try to make watch parts out of this material and start this whole ball rolling for everyone else to come in later on and grab hold of. Because for me, I'm an innovator. That's just what drives me inside.
Yeah.
It's not that I'm telling you I'm an innovator. It's just that's what I am inside. I'm always, you know, on the computer looking for new ways to do stuff.
Yeah.
And groundbreaking areas. And whoever's first to me, and I, again, with my music, same kind of thing. Whoever's first is first. The rest, yeah. they're just borrowing, copying, moving along. Sometimes they take it to a new level, but it's the guy who's first and you're first. So how did you just go, hey, man, I can make watch parts out of this and you tell us all?
Johan, he was already an accomplished bladesmith when we met. He had won awards in Atlanta, Paris, numerous places, in night shows, like for best steel during the show. And he is also a creative guy, and he is also looking for new ways to use his material. And I believe around 2005, he got the idea to use his steel for watches. And he approached a couple of watchmakers, even a Swiss guy, but everyone realized this will take some time to get to life. Mm-hmm. And also, it was he had a couple of watches made by the Swiss watchmaker, but the end result was nothing close to what Johan had in mind. It used his steel, but it had nothing to do with Swedish heritage or like Viking look and feel. So he started to look for watchmakers closer nearby, and he called the watchmaker school, explained a bit about what he wanted to do, and they recommended him to call me.
Wow.
Because
that's great.
Good thing. But the teachers at the school recognized, because when I was studying, nowadays most of the focus is on service watchmaking in the schools. But I wanted to learn as much about the traditional handcraft as possible, and the teacher had noticed my interest. And my willingness to learn all the traditional ways of making things. And also I had actually built a couple of things already in school. So they recommended him to contact me, and he called me, and we met just the next day, and we clicked right on. And that was the summer of 2007, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
We started to discuss watches, designs during autumn, and the first watches were made and sold, actually, spring.
Well, at that time, and first of all, I want to say, see everybody go to watch school. It pays off.
Yeah.
But at that time, what was Johan's idea? Like, was he just looking to make a case and then you kind of put a movement in it? Or what was his idea that he brought to the table? And then how did you escalate that into, you know, what you guys have as the marriage it is today? Because those are the stories young people who are watchmakers, you're figuring out their way of what they want to make into, you know, their brand and their timepiece. Yeah. If they happen to collide with someone like this, it would be a very interesting story to know, you know, what did you bring to the table? What did he bring to the table? And what was the marriage?
Yeah, His vision, he had already actually the guy the Swiss watchmaker was complete Damascus steel. The whole watch was made from one piece of Damascus steel, but it was very, very rough and square and nothing Vikingish at all.
Awesome.
I guess Johan's vision was to use as much of his steel as possible into the watch, but I came from a different side of things. I wanted it to be more. I wanted to bring more high-end watchmaking, into the end product. But his vision was to use as much as possible from his material. But there are of course limitations to what can be done. One of his unique skills, is his ability to extract color from the steel. Maybe there will be some colors, pictures, Johnny. I'm not sure.
Yeah,
but you are, as a watchmaker, you know, we can do orange, purple. Here's a multicolor dial that Johan did the tempering on, and as you see, it's both blue and purple.
It's beautiful.
And he developed, as a watchmaker, we use heat tempering, and that limits the color palette to three colors basically. But Johan has a wider spectrum because he uses a different coloring method. Use a hot salt liquid, so he can get almost any color from the rainbow from the steels, and he knows exactly which steels to use to get the best colors. And so there are a lot of variations to do to get this coloring, but yeah. That's also a plus and a minus, because every dial made in that way is super unique. Both that, the pattern and the color is unique.
But that is what independent watchmaking is.
Yeah.
Just, I mean, that's it. Just fits right in that in what we are supposed to represent. Which means even if we're a straight up the line traditional watchmaker in independent, when that person makes their second watch, it's different because we're hand finishing. And,
exactly,
and it should be that way. It's a piece of us. That's beautiful, man. Johan is a Viking master, or you said Vikingish.
Yeah,
it's crazy, isn't it?
That picture had some because I wanted to introduce Damascus steel into the case, but make it more elegant. So for the case, we are using stainless Damascus steel, but that's also made in Sweden, and it's forged. In a way that's customized by us, and Johan can also forge the stainless Damascus steel. But that's, and we developed the process to make more contrast out of that. Mm. And that's a steel you actually see in a competitor watches. We first exhibited in Basel, I think it was 2012 or 13. Mm-hmm. And 2016 you saw two or three other brands using the same kind of stainless Damascus steel into their watches. But
that's okay, you know. That's why we're here today talking.
Yeah.
And that's why me and Johnny do what we do, because, you know, what I said before, in my past world, I'm a great believer in who is the originator. You know, in music, you hunt back. You hear something, and you go, oh, that's cool. But then you say, well, who where did that start? And then you find the dude who eventually started that riff. And that sound, and you're like, oh, Tony Iommi, Black Sabbath. That's where it all started.
Yeah.
Okay. Without the him, there is no heavy metal. It doesn't exist at all, ever. It never would have. And it's the same thing in watches. So, you know, the innovator is where we're sitting with today, and that's why we're getting it from, per se, the Viking's mouth.
Yeah, and also, since we had the input of Johan from early on, I could apply watchmaker finishing to Damascus steel, and also get his input of how to do things. So what I do is a mix of steel making, knife making techniques with watchmaker finishing techniques, and that's what makes the result.
What are you using mechanically inside the watch?
We use Swiss movements all the way. I use chronometer spec movements that I modify to a certain degree. Sometime in the future, I would love to make my own movements, but I have to be realistic about that. So,
Have you thought about making some parts of the movement?
I've made the first Damascus steel bridges. That was almost 10 years ago now.
Yeah.
So I made a quite big modification. Yeah, that's the latest one. So we have evolved that bit quite a lot since the first one. And for that one, I also refinished the main plate with the pelage and did the rhodium plating in-house and did the finishing of the wheels. So quite a lot of work.
Where are you making the bridges, that bridge in-house?
Yeah, I make them here.
Isn't that beautiful? Isn't that absolutely astonishingly beautiful?
I am so
in love with what this guy does. I just love it. And I think you have been manufacturing your own parts. Should we look at the detail of that there?
Yeah, I haven't seen this one yet. That's why I'm kind of just sucking this right in.
Yeah.
So, because I think Patrick is like, oh, yeah, by the way, yeah, I do that here. You know what I mean? we'll just make Damascus bridges in my
yeah.
And this is the other thing. We're gonna keep spreading this. It's, you know, that word in-house movement, you know, that all the big brands have grasped and stolen from all of us, because again, we're the originators. Patrick's the original. We're changing it. I changed it yesterday. It's called In My House. Top that one, right? We're beyond in-house. It's really in our houses. So we're in my house. Yeah. So Patrick's making that bridge in his house. So Patrick, tell us, like, are you getting that metal from Johan, like, already colored? And you have a small CNC machine. I think you told me, right? A small CNC machine that you're using to...
Yeah, so... What I get from Johan is a square piece of patterned welded steel. It's 45 square piece, 45, 45, and 3 millimeters thick. That's very roughly. Yeah. So that's what I get, basically.
Wow.
And then the beautiful pattern is inside. You don't see that until you have actually flat. Milled it and put it in acid. That's the first time you see the result. So making the pattern, making the steel is done blind. So you have to know, be aware of all the steps you're doing as you make the steel, because everything you do will affect the end result.
Yeah.
You mean how fast your milling machine is running?
Not the speed, but how many layers? Because it consists of two different steel types. That's what makes the pattern, because they react differently to the acid. And we also use, between the layers, we use a thin layer of nickel to add an extra highlight.
So you're getting the raw stock 45 by 45 millimeters. You're milling it on the CNC machine. I can see, you know, once we mill it, the unique patterns come out. It's just an ice cream swirl, everybody. Okay, it's an ice cream swirl of metal. So wherever you cut, whatever you do, however deep you go, you're going to get different patterns, which is
exactly
your timepiece. What you wear on your wrist is yours, and it's somebody else's, which is really awesome. But after that bridge is done, okay, it looks like it's a 6498 or 6497.
Yeah, it's based on that,
right? Okay. And then you're soaking it in acid, and the color starts to come out. What else do you have to do to get it into the state that it's ready to be used in the timepiece?
Well, the finishing steps are quite intricate because I do traditional watchmaker finishing with bevel polishing, bevel shaping first, polishing, and then the acid to bring the pattern out. And then flat sanding, of course, flat polishing. And then often I have to do multiple acid baths to get the right depth, because I want the pattern to be deep. But maybe you don't see it.
But how did you do that gold pattern in that?
Oh, that's engraved.
And who's doing that?
That's by one of the best knife makers in the world. A Swedish guy on the West Coast, Anders Hedlund.
Beautiful.
He is also a master engraver, and that's one of his specialities, to do gold-filled engravings. And is it possible to zoom in, Johnny?
I can, if you give me a moment, I can come back out and I can get another image of that there.
The engraving also has a frame that has chamfered, a polished chamfer.
Okay.
To frame the gold inlay. So it's very, very intricate.
Who's making the channel? He's hand engraving the channel himself, and then he's
hand engraving and gold
filling. He's kind of englaging the inner channel before he's putting the gold in. Is that what you're trying to tell everybody?
No, it's like three lines. So it's like chamfers on the side that are polished, and then in the middle here, there's a recess that is gold filled,
mm-hmm.
And the chamfers are polished, so mm-hmm. they will get the same finish that I do on the bridge chamfers.
Right, and you're doing all the anglage on the outer perimeter of the bridges, and all the sanding and all the
Keep talking, guys. I'm working on that image. It's gonna be with you.
Yeah. No. It's this. I don't know how I haven't seen this. It's
because
I try to see everything from everybody.
Yeah.
But this is killer, man. Yeah, really beautiful. I'm only saying that because it's black. You know, I mean, I'm metal. You know, I mean, it's almost like a shade of ebony with browns and blacks and. It's just beautiful, man.
And now, if you look on the sides of the gold inlay, you see that there are 45-degree chamfers. And you also see how the pattern continues. It gives an angle to the pattern, how it continues deeper
in
the metal.
Okay, John, if you don't mind, there's a couple people that have written some questions in, so I think we definitely should address this right off the bat. Because we're not working with brass, and we're not working with titanium, so we're working with steel. Steel is magnetic. So for people,
okay, I'll do that. So do you want to deal with this question first then?
Captain Forrest asked, how's it working with padded forged steel compared to brass, like when making movement parts? Philip Norbell said, hi guys, is it possible to have magnetism interference cause of the steel on the balance spring? So Patrick, I will go, this is your time.
I'll start first with the hardness. Of course, it's a lot harder to machine than brass. It's even harder to work in than German nickel. But I managed to do it. So it was a trial and error process to learn what type of milling tools to use, and actually to mill it on a watchmaker lathe. That's maybe I shouldn't say that, but it's quite easy. To me, it's easy to do it on the lathe. But to mill movement parts is more difficult because it's harder. And it can eat all your tools in no time if you do it the wrong way.
I'm with you because a lot of my movement is steel, as people are starting to see. So I can finish it different ways than Norm. So steel, it destroys our tooling. It destroys thousands and thousands of dollars of tooling per part just to try to get something that might even work, to find out that doesn't really work long enough. So for those who don't, we just see what the end result when we post a picture or something, and like, oh, dude, that's cool, man. That's great. I can't believe how fast you made that. No, I'm just not showing you the pile of money that's on my floor, and none of us are. But Patrick, about magnetism, let's.
Yeah, of course. We use for the dial and for the movement parts, we use carbon steel, so Swedish tool steels, the best possible quality, and it's possible to magnetize those parts, but I do whatever what's possible to reduce magnetism here in the workshop. I have a demagnetizer, and also nowadays the hairspring is fairly non-magnetic, so it's not a big problem, and actually. I've had this problem or these questions ever since we started. And 2 years ago, I was very pleased to see F.B. Jorn introduce a Damascus steel dial into one of their watches. And as you know, F.B. Jorn is hysterical about accuracy of their movements. And if they can use a Damascus steel dial, then I guess it's not a big deal, it's also easy to demagnetize a watch nowadays, and basically any watch repair should have a demagnetizer. And
so for people who are watching who are just trying to understand this or get into a collector that's getting into the timepieces like us, steel can demagnetized.
Yeah.
The old pocket watches, the hairspring, were not, they could be magnetized, which changes the timing of your watch. So if it was once it got magnetized, instead of your watch keeping a good time, it just goes nuts. And there's other parts in the watch. So if that's one of the big reasons why most of the parts are made out of brass, and then we rhodium plate them. If you ever question, hey, why are they making it out of that cheap brass crap? You know, there's your answer. It's not cheap brass crap.
Or German silver.
And then later on, German silver. Yeah. Later on, I think maybe once we developed speakers and people listen to music, there's giant magnets in speakers, and people would take the watch off. It's a common thing that I had very early on as I was doing after sales service. And you know, you have a beautiful stereo system. It's actually a very widespread hobby for many people who are watch collectors. They take the watch off, it might be getting sweaty or what, and they put on a speaker. And all of a sudden now, your watch is not running right. And that's really was the cause of a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
And people that came into my store. We take your watch apart, we demagnetize the parts. But that's not so much anymore today.
No, I completely understand the question, because magnetism used to be watchmaking's enemy number one. Mm-hmm. But I don't think it is so anymore. Now it's dust and water.
I'm good in mine, because my design for my timepiece, the whole escapement is now titanium, and lots of broken tools on the floor. So I don't have the I can have steel bridges in my timepiece as well. So we all have a way to kind of skirt around that problem. And once the non-magnetic hairspring was invented, it's pretty much non-magnetic. Most of this theory of this is now gone. We can use other materials. And that's why you're starting to see other materials across the board.
Mm. Yeah. And also there are like some of the best watchmakers in the world make watches completely, almost, or at least cases and dials out of meteorite. And it has the same properties as Damascus steel, basically. It can be very, very magnetized.
That's very good you said that, because people think of it as a rock.
Yeah, it's not. Yeah, it's not. Metal.
Oh, meteorite. Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So if you have questions of magnetism, then check out the brands who use meteorite as diamonds.
Antoine Pretioso,
including Rolex.
Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah.
So now we put that question forever to bed for anybody in the history of watchmaking from this point forward.
Thanks, Dan.
Yeah, no problem.
Great question, Philippe. Thank you very much.
That was really good.
Yeah, yeah. So actually, Philippe, I hope that will be on with us one of these days, Dan. So he's a great guy, young independent watchmaker as well. So, yeah. So, you were asking about if we could get an image of color of Patrick. That's the Sarek, if I'm not wrong. Is it? Yeah. And, the colors, that to me looks like, you know, petrol, gasoline on a puddle of water. Effect. And it's spectacular. Dan, can you see why I love these so much?
Yeah. It's the uniqueness. It's personable as well. That's why I love anything that's like that, because everybody gets to pick what is theirs and the uniqueness of that, because we're all unique beings, and that's what independent watchmaking represents. And to find that and create your art from that is very difficult to do. And this has changed our industry. Even the big brands are trying to steal this idea and figure it out.
Yeah.
And commercialize it.
So Patrick, to do this, the colors that are in that are absolutely amazing. The spectrum of colors that are in this. And it's named, of course, after the Sarek National Park.
Exactly. I think that dial was what named the whole collection initially. because I showed that dial to my wife, who is from Lapland, and she said immediately, that looks like a very famous valley in Sarek National Park. It's Rapa Valley. So that's where the name came from initially. So that's the dial that named the whole collection, actually.
Fabulous. Fabulous. So, and okay, if you're not giving away too many secrets, then obviously there are people who would love to know how you do this. But what is this? Is this a process of acid? Does that color exist in that particular piece of Damascus steel that Johan has given you, or is the color there? You can extract that color using different techniques yourself.
No, the color is always unique. And like the pattern, and it's done blind, actually. So Johan has a liquid, he heats up salt. It's a mix, a secret mix, but it's a salt mix that he heats up and it dips the steel. And depending on the temperature and how long it's dipped, the colors that are extracted on the steel are different, it starts from yellow, red, yellow, orange, red, purple, blue, and green, even. Mm-hmm. And every dial can have a mix of all those colors, and black, of course.
It's a funny thing, because I want to know how you do it, but I also want to protect.
They're doing either, so don't worry about it. He's just making steel, and then they're slicing it like cheese, and whatever it comes out.
Their finger.
Actually, even if I said the exact ingredients of this salt, it would be very difficult to duplicate because Johan has developed this coloring process for his knives for some time. So it's also the finishing of the steel he does that makes the color really pop.
Yeah, but what you just said earlier, Patrick, that it comes to you in a nice, say, 45x45 piece of.
But
piece of he's already treated that with the salt. Or are you cutting it?
No,
we're talking about, say, you're making just a bridge. Let's keep it simple. Do you send that back to him to soak in the salt, or are you doing that in house by you?
So far, we have not done the coloring on bridges, because now I'm revealing a secret here. Because to make the best colors, but you know this as a watchmaker, to make the best colors from steel, it has to be hardened. Mm-hmm. And you know that from bluing steel. Mm-hmm. If the steel is hardened, the blue color is deeper. And it's the same thing with Johan's coloring. So the dial has to be hardened. So we for the dials, we ship them a lot back and forth between the GOS workshop and his smithy, because it's there he creates the steel. Mm-hmm. And it's there he does the raw dials. He delivers the dials like raw. See if I can show you some.
I have one of the here, but it's not a raw dial, it's a finished dial.
But, no. So I can show you. This is a typical dial as delivered from Johan.
See, that's what I'm looking for.
Oh, wow.
So this is, it's just been flat sanded.
Right.
And quickly put in acid to reveal the pattern. And when we do that, I'm able to like orient to put the dial to make it the most balanced look as a dial.
Getting the first geometric pattern to pop through so you know where you're going to put things.
Yeah, we want to have the perfect balance to use this as a dial.
Okay.
So I try to find the best way to orient this. And then based on that, I machine the dial. I place all the holes for the dial feet, or the markings rather, for dial feet and for index rings. I do that, and then I do maybe improve the surface finishing a bit because I have a bit more refined tools for that. And then yeah, that's after my finishing. This could be returned to Johan for coloring, but this is this pattern is actually too dense to be colored. So this one we kept as it was. Yeah, what we did was in addition to the acid treatment to get the pattern out, we also have a contrast treatment to bring out the maximum contrast between the components of the material. You see, there are two different grayscales.
Yeah.
Right.
And then there are, you see the nickel, the highlights in between.
Okay, yeah. I see where you're going with this. Very cool. Go ahead.
Yeah. So there are so many steps to reach this end result. So.
Right. Because he's worked with it so long, he can target just the different properties that are, let's say, ice cream swirl together with different treatments to make certain parts of it pop or not pop or set back. Is that what you try to express a little bit? Not just soak in a salt bath and then you're done, here's what you get, but he can actually go further with heat and different avenues.
It's once the pattern is there, you cannot alter the pattern.
You can make certain parts like you were just explaining, different metallurgies that are the mix, he can work.
Yeah, but you have to do that in the first step. So that's, you cannot do that afterwards.
You have
to do that when you select the two different steel types you want to use. Mm-hmm. So you have to decide already then what kind of colors you want to pop when you do the coloring. So you can't do that as like the last step.
So you have to
plan it.
I wasn't aware of that. And now, I know I've written about GOS in the past. I think in some of my articles I said there are 192 layers of steel. Is that right?
It depends on the part we are making. I think for the last dial you showed, I think that was 192.
192 layers.
But if you want more vivid colors, you have to reduce the layers. So for the original Sarek dials, I think this was something maybe 90 layers, because we want to have wider lines in the pattern, so you have more color.
Mind blowing. If you think about it, and people, if you're watching, if you think about the processes that are involved here to create that one dial, is the 90 layers of steel that are then, as you said, milled and then flat sanded to extrapolate. I used the word extrapolate. I don't think I've ever used it before. But you're exploiting those natural swirls, that characteristic of the Damascus steel.
Yeah.
If you could fill some of the watchmakers in, so everybody that understands this, Patrick works alone, and he has his own workshop. It's not this massive 17-floor conglomerate with many, many people to produce what you're seeing there, which is quite mind-boggling, and that's what independent watchmaking is. Yeah. So I'd like to dive in a little bit and let people know that it's very much, because we all choose different paths, it's a very much a minimalist workshop geared directly towards exactly what you do. If you could fill people in on, I know you have a small CNC machine, you have a beautiful, I think a Shablon 5th, not a Shablon, a Bergeon 50 lathe, right? Which is, if you could tell people what's in your workshop and any kind of specialized tools that you actually needed to do what you do.
Yeah, I've been, you know, I'm not from a watchmaker family, so I did not inherit any tools. So I had to like purchase everything on a need to have basis. Mm-hmm. And but also the way my focus as a watchmaker is as always. Or anything I do in craft, really, is finishing. So most of the tools I've made has actually been for hand finishing. And I've already for some of the early watches we made, I made the hands myself. And I made special tools for doing the chamfers and doing the that's a later one, but mm-hmm. you can see how I like attach the hand to the support mm-hmm. to do the chamfering and the polishing, and this hand actually has a finishing I developed for the Viking watch we made
it's beautiful
2 years ago.
And you can see
I call it a bit tongue-in-cheek Cottage US, because it's based on Côte de Genève, but it's...
What do you call it? Cottage
US.
Cottage US.
I got it.
Why not?
It's almost completely flat, but I wanted to bring the illusion of it to be curved, like the spearheads.
It's like a herringbone, nearly, isn't it? It's beautiful, absolutely beautiful.
So this finishing combines machine finishing for the top surface and hand finishing on the anglage.
The anglage around it. Anglage, ladies and gentlemen, friends and followers of In the Metal, anglage is that highly polished edging right around the side. You find it here on the you can see it on the hand here, that polished, and it is so difficult to it is laboriously painstaking to do, because you're using wood and paste basically.
I'm not using wood pegs. I made my own finishing sticks.
I should have known.
Of course, because I and that's something I brought with me when I showed how I do this in Dubai last year. So mm-hmm. I made my a large number of my own finishing sticks wow. to bring to Dubai.
What do you mean by finishing sticks? Are they made out of steel or?
Just a minute.
That's far enough, Patrick. Off you go, my man.
This is the part we like when they go back in, deep into his drawer and they pull it out.
Not really. But I could tell that one of the exhibitors in Dubai was very interested in what I brought. It's a wooden stick. Similar to what coffee shops or what you see,
yeah,
Starbucks. Yeah. Starbucks, but and I use modern finishing film, and instead of using normally in traditional watchmaking, you use knives and you sharpen the tools. Mm-hmm. But instead of doing that, I wanted to be more effective, so I do this. Whenever I need a sharp edge. So that took me about 2 seconds to.
You can tell he's been through watchmaking school.
So they were also very, very surprised when I brought these to Dubai. I hadn't seen that on the finishing workbench before.
So you're using like the 3M films like that were
I think it's.
It's really, yes, that, it's, those things have revolutionized what we do.
I think they first came when I was in watchmaker school, And I thought they were, but at first they were
I had them way back in WoStep when in 1995 they were
okay.
Yeah, they were still they were there.
Okay. They arrived.
They only made the round ones back then. They're hard to find now.
Yeah, but I do these myself, and because I become accustomed to this quick way of finishing. But then I have a very trusty lathe. My lathe Bergeron 50, I use that for a lot of stuff.
Where did you find that? Because it's, as everyone knows, it's a beautiful lathe, but not many of us could afford it way back when. And industry really didn't buy that model lathe for some reason. I don't know why. And it's a kick-ass lathe. It was kind of like the answer to the favorite. So where did you find that?
I was fortunate to be able to get them when the watchmaker school. They had some lathes that were not in use, so they auctioned them out. Actually, you know that the prices, the original purchase prices for these things are
crazy.
And I even got the milling attachment, so I can do. I can do basically anything on that machine.
Just that's like buying a Mercedes, you know.
Bergeron, it's everything with the word Bergeron attached.
No, that's crazy money.
So I jumped of joy when I got that.
Yeah,
into the workshop.
And glage is a word again that's being kind of thrown around now, just like in-house movement and all that crap. And glage, if you buy an inexpensive timepiece, you'll see that the there's bevels are all on the bridges when you have a look inside. They're manufactured via CNC or whoever else they're doing it. It's mainly CNC. And some of them are very beautiful, and they come right off the machine, and that's how they go out. Other companies at the next tier, they take what comes off that machine, and they will hand polish that, and they'll say, hand polished and glage. It's not okay when you get to the top like me, because people have asked me, as my parts are being made here, you know, why don't you just have use your machine and do it? There's something that is an unexplained for to do this by the human hand. First of all, no two are the same, but around the corners, around the edges, how we want to do it in our own mind as us, how we get into the little crevices, a machine would do it beautifully. I can do it. Most people won't even tell the difference when it gets in the corners, it's too machiney. And I'm the programmer, so I can program this thing. I do everything here.
Me
it's
too.
It's just not even close, not even in the ballpark when we look at something that's done by hand like Patrick does, and all that time we spend. And you're seeing this on social media a lot. How much time a true independents are spending on this? It's 80% of our time, pretty much. It really shows, and it's a humanist. So if someone does it one way or another way, there's a right way and a wrong way, but not really.
Nope. And the finishing is also like the signature of the watchmaker. So someone who's working in a name brand finishing workshop, they can tell that which part was made by which watchmaker. And that's also one reason the premier brands use one watchmaker to do a single movement.
Yes,
exactly.
Because everything needs to look the same.
Exactly. You know, that's really wonderful that you said that, Patrick, because that also is something that we need to kind of let people know, because they do see other independents. And they strive to have that one guy to train him to, okay, from beginning to end, here's all the raw parts. And again, they might even come off, you know, what I call prototype CNC machines like Patrick has. They're raw. They're no different than if I made them on the jig ball right here. We purposely make them raw so that person's signature is in that watch. And that's why they are one person does everything. It would look really weird if I did I did a balance bridge, the other guy did the escape wheel or sub-second cock, it just would. It's just not human. It would be like two humans. It's just weird. So that's something we should definitely talk more about, because it's absolutely true, Patrick. Glad you brought that up. That's a very important point. Killer, man. Yeah. So you're killing it there, man. You're just killing it.
Absolutely. I am going to do something here that we haven't done before, Dan, and I'm springing this on you, but we're just literally hitting the 1 hour mark. So we're going to wrap up this part and start immediately in about 10 seconds time with another question and looking at a different aspect of it. So so thank you. And here we go, everybody. Welcome to In the Metal Part 2 with Patrick Sorgan and from GOS Watches in Linköping in Sweden. And we're going to try and divide this one up into maybe two episodes or two parts, so which we've just done. So sorry for springing that one on you, Dan. So
I was waiting for a birthday cake or something. I don't know what's going on.
We've never ever had a thing end exactly at 59 minutes and 50 seconds. Shit, hang on, this is a good opportunity to do this. let's see. I'm learning this as we go along, as you know. But so there's a couple of questions, and let's start off with Philippe Norbel had asked another question, and it was regarding the use of the acid bath to get different volumes. Or I'm not sure what you mean there, Philippe, whether it's different types of acid, different formula to get different colors or different...
I really don't know what he means with volumes, but I can say that we do more heavy etching than any other brand who's trying to use Damascus steel, because I want the three-dimensional effect, and you want to. We want the three-dimensional effect of the pattern to bring it more come to life. And we do that for all types of steel. It adds contrast as well as dynamics, because you can play more with the reflections. So
what about the case? We haven't talked about the case. Where is that? Is that being manufactured by another Swedish firm or...?
For the gold case, I make the parts here.
Really?
I collaborate with a local goldsmith. So mm-hmm. I can show you some. These are parts in silver that were, cast. Mm-hmm. So I made originals that were made I gave to the goldsmith, and he cast the parts for me. And the first one was silver, just to make sure the measurements were right. Mm-hmm. And then I do the rest of it on my trusty Bergeron 50.
You make cases out of Damascus as well. Are you making that in your workshop or?
Yeah, but. We for the one you saw early on, that case ring was made by a case manufacturer in Germany, mm-hmm. but it's Swedish steel that we sent to Germany to be milled for us, because at that time we did not have the capacity, the machinery to mill that.
So now any new case or any new design you're making first.
Yeah, that's what I'm.
You're making the blank, and then you're giving it, if it's going to be in gold or whatever.
Yeah.
You're giving it. So it's in house again. You're making the case in house, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah. So that started with the Viking watch, the Varing watch we made 2 or 3 years ago, where I learned how to make the case parts in bronze. So it was, that's a Varing, the bronze watch. So then I learned to machine case parts from bronze, and I also made the hand and the index ring also from bronze in-house.
All on the Bergeron 50?
No, I also use the CNC. The CNC has helped me a lot, both to in the ability to machine more complex movement parts, but also to machine case parts.
Did you build the CNC machine?
I built it actually from parts received from the U.S. So it's based on a TIG mill that's converted to quite a good precision three-axis lathe that's controlled by software, also U.S. software. I'm running in the workshop here. And the TIG is really sturdy, and it's a benchtop CNC, unlike most people believe that all CNC machines are like 2-ton monsters. Mm-hmm. But there are actually benchtop CNCs that are quite okay. It does not have like 1,000 millimeter precision, but it's really good enough for me. Mm-hmm. I think it's close to 5,000 millimeters precision. Mm-hmm. So it's well enough to make case parts, definitely.
And this is what smaller independent watchmakers should understand if they want to dive into that kind of prototype, hands-on type CNC, which is really what we need to make some bridges and make random parts here or there. You don't need $250,000 in oven and giant electricity bills. A lot of my friends are doing the same thing. So we can make repetitive parts. But again, what people have to understand is it's you doing the programming, it's you doing the work, it's you checking the part. So it really is no different than setting up an automatic pinion maker from the 1950s. Because this is something that we should really give a little analogy to, because people look at those old machines and they're so beautiful. Like, say, let's use a pinion maker, right? So you spend a week, it could be up to a week, setting it up for a certain pinion, right? And then eventually when you get it right to make your seconds wheel pinion, right? It's a sub-second wheel pinion. Yeah. Then a guy presses go and he makes 50, 60, 100 pinions. So what's the difference between that if the same gentleman is the programmer, he's the CAD designer of the part, he checks the program, puts it in a little benchtop CNC or a CNC mill he converted his Schaublin 70 to BCNC, and then he's sitting there and he's doing it all one guy, right? Same thing. And then he presses start on that machine and it makes him his pinion and he has to put the blank back in. It's the same thing. It's just a modern day version of that old machine. So
exactly. People
have to get that thought out of their head that it's like an easy bake oven. We just chuck the Damascus in there and look at all my parts.
I don't know.
Just put them together.
And then it's all the hand finishing that goes into it. The CNC just helps you to create the part. Then there's all the hand finishing that goes into it. The watch, Johnny, you showed just a minute ago, that's the Viking watch. That's number zero. And all bronze you see here was programmed, made on a CNC by my program. So I made the design and the program and selected all the toolings and speeds and everything to make these parts, including the hands. But then, of course, it had to be finished to look like that. So a lot of the work goes into both creating the parts on the CNC mill and then hand finishing. And this bronze is pre-patinated, so it does not change much.
And it won't age.
It will age. It will darken a bit. But I've seen a couple of clients' watches 2 years after, and it looks pretty much the same.
Wow. it's amazing to see these.
That's a model we made in honor of a local Viking leader from Linköping, actually. He returned back to Linköping after having helped King Knut get the throne of England. I think it was 1008.
I think they want him back again.
Yeah. I'll check. Maybe he's available.
I think I could do with him. All right. You know.
Yeah, that's King Philip was a great, great king. He was,
as an American, it just freaks me out. Like, even people, you know, from Sweden or in Europe, they say, yeah, 1,008. Like, our country is so young. People here are like, my house is 30 years old. It's falling apart, man. And I remember, like, the first tour, again, like, I went over as a musician in the 80s to go tour Europe. And, like, I just come out of my hotel and look at, like, the building is, like, stamped, you know, when it was built. And it's, like, 7 million years before Christ. I'm like, how's this thing, like, still standing, you know? It's so cool, man.
Yeah,
it's so cool.
Yeah.
Well, I think 2007, I realized, I learned about this guy named Varing, the local leader. And I put one and one together and realized he must have returned to Linköping from England 2008. So we made this model in his honor, to him and his crew.
That to me, you know, there's such authenticity. There's real meaning in what you do. I've always really loved that about GOS, and I'm not sure GOS has always had the exposure, the appreciation that I honestly believe that it deserves. And I think tonight we're getting a really good insight.
Well, once again, he's doing what I'm trying to do here in my country. Which hasn't been done in like, what, 150 years, is he's representing his country and that heritage of his country in his art, just like all artists do. That's what modern day independent watchmaking is. And it's being embraced globally from Japan now. And as you can see, me and Johnny, you know, are talking with Patrick in Sweden. I'm from, you know, the United States, getting ready to represent my country. And this is the birth of the third wave, I feel, of independent watchmaking. Mm-hmm. And it's the story behind each one of us that really do kind of rise to the top. And it's not about a brand. It's just about, it's like our religion. It's where we're from. It's the mean everything since we were born in our country, what it means to us. And it's coming out through our art. And Patrick was representing that. And I agree with you, Johnny. He needs to, be known way more.
I don't think it's particularly any it's Patrick's fault or anything like that. I think there is this belief that, you know, watchmaking is Swiss, and you know, you gotta buy a Swiss watch, or you gotta buy a watch that comes from South Germany or Eastern Germany for quality. But you know, and Captain Forrest has been on there a few minutes ago to actually highlight this. And it's not off topic at all, Captain Forrest. How is the watchmaking school scene in Sweden? In Finland, you have Voutilainen and Sarpaneva and more. But the only watchmaking school was almost closed with no funds and no government funding. And it's the same in Ireland, because we had a watchmaking school, the Swiss Irish Horological Institute, and it closed its doors about 20 years ago as well. And it had alumni like McGonagall and Stephen McDonald and people like that. And it is difficult I think part of the problem is the perception of watches that are not made in Switzerland, basically. And we're getting a really good insight into heck.
Well, I think what we have to transmit here is, since I went to school and Carrie Voutilainen and all the other people that graduated from the famous true Wolfstep school in Neuchâtel that I went to, I'll back you up on that, Johnny, because previous to that, I did a 4-year school at the Bulova School of Watchmaking in New York, in Queens, and that closed down too. But that was at a time where, you know, watchmakers just it wasn't a field people were going into. So, and the what has happened since then is the Wolfstep program from Antoine Simonet, who was my teacher, has been implemented to many schools. So that curriculum is what Patrick I think, if I'm correct me if I'm wrong, learned from in his school. So you didn't have to go to Switzerland. So nowadays, this WoSTEP program is global. So the proper training is being done in all the countries. And when that was started to be implementing back in 95 or 96, when it was starting, that was the purpose. It's to rise up who Patrick is and who the rest of these people are around the world into what independent watchmaking is, because now they're trained correctly in Japan, in what's the new school that just opened up?
Cambodia.
Asia somewhere, Singapore maybe.
Cambodia.
Cambodia, because McGonagall's brother is teaching
there. McGonagall has set up.
That's a school worth to like leave your any country and go to as well.
That would be amazing. Yeah. If I were a young person, I would love that experience.
So Patrick, take over. So I'm not just.
Yeah, I'm a young person by then.
So you went to school. You went to school in Sweden under the WoSTEP program.
Yeah. I don't remember when it was. Okay for WoSTEP, but at least when I studied there, it did. But what the Swedish school tried to do was to merge two traditions: the WoSTEP tradition with the Swedish watchmaking tradition. And we have a lot of in Sweden, you know, being a outback watchmaker in Sweden, you have to rely on your own skills. A lot. So you have to be able to solve a lot of problems. So Swedish watchmaking tradition and the training for it has been very wide, a lot more wider than the WoSTEP school. So for example, we start by working with clocks.
Yeah.
And I believe that the watchmakers will still do that. So we start with clocks and also pocket watches, but after the first semester, we are supposed to, all the students were supposed to have built our own table clock, out of a pile of wheels and spring barrels and you know what. So already from the first semester, we get very much hands-on, and when we create our own clock, we design how the wheels are positioned and everything already that early. So I think that's part of the Swedish tradition that goes into it. But then it's been merged with the WoSTEP tradition, and I believe the number of students that managed to get to the level is quite high among Swedish students. I think it was a close call a couple of years ago of it having to close, but it's so far so good.
Yeah.
And when I started, there was a lot of Norwegian students, because in Norway there was no watchmaker school. So they came to Sweden to study.
It's very sad to read, you know, because I think as all independent watchmakers know that school in Finland is an incredible school. And we all did watch it almost close. And hopefully by doing this show and other people hopefully can carry the torch to let governments and other people know of this incredible emerging field that is independent watchmaking, that it's art. It's not, hey, I want to go to school to learn how to repair a watch. You know, it's birthing of a whole new generation of creativity that who knows where we'll be at that next generation. And I think the school should more concentrate KWHCC, a school in Switzerland, on making your own bridges, making your own parts, and not just repair, because that's where a lot of people want to head. Of course, you need to do at least 10 years or so of after sales service after school. Otherwise, you know, you're not going to see enough to gain enough knowledge, just like any other profession. You can't be a lawyer, come out of Harvard Law School, and your first day is in front of the nastiest judge that there is, you know, in a murder case. You'd be an idiot, right? Because the guy be in jail for life. So it's the same kind of principle. Yeah. We all want you to get more experience, not school experience, but school should bend a little bit and not just teach a repair that was done in the 80s and 90s. That's just not cutting it anymore. And then they can lobby the government, I think, and get some money and extra funding and create some creative people and give them their creative freedom.
Yeah.
Just my two cents.
I have an opinion too, and this is going back to what you were saying there a couple of minutes ago about being in Sweden, being detached from, you know, where there was two different philosophies being applied in the college. So we get watches that are so different, like yours, like GOS watches. I would say similar in Russia, where there's no formal education system there, so you get Konstantin Chaikin.
Yeah.
And his watches are not like anybody else's watches. Mm-hmm. You know, because there's no... There's nobody has put you on
a box.
Yeah, and sort of said, you've got to do it this way. So there's a much freer approach to your materials, to your design, to the influences, to even to thinking, I can do this. Do the way that you have used Damascus steel and your heritage, the Nordic heritage. It's so obvious in your watches, you know, and I think that's because you're not educated or not formally brought up in Switzerland. I think the same applies to yourself, Dan, as well, because you're creating a watch that probably wouldn't be made.
I'm just an against all rules and bosses and suit and ties and going to work in cubicles. It doesn't fit my skin. And luckily, I was abused as a child to be able to have a guitar and be able to break all those rules too young. So I can't conform. So I'm a mystery.
Yeah. The point being, that your watch would probably not get made in Switzerland, you know, because of the difference.
There's not a chance in hell my watch would get made.
No, I think Dan and I, we pour our whole souls into every aspect of the watch.
Yeah.
And especially me, I know some watchmakers shake their heads when they see another watchmaker who enjoy working with hands and cases as much as working on the movement. But that's me. I enjoy, and that's also what I think is also a Swedish tradition, because we are supposed to be able to make everything as a Swedish watchmaker.
That's, yeah. Here, can we look at your crown?
Yeah.
Yeah? Because, again, I think it's the detailing.
That's a hand-sculpted crown for the latest
the Scotty watch. Yeah. The Scotty watch. We're going to have a look at the Scotty watch in a minute.
I do the markings and the initial filing on the Bergeonlay. And yes. I use the positioning, what's it called? Help me then.
Indexer.
Indexer, yeah. to get the 9 to 8 positions there.
And where else did you get that?
And then it's hand filed and hand finished and then polished. And that is stainless Damascus steel, but you don't see the pattern yet.
Because the pattern is...
You have to put it in acid to reveal the pattern. And like I said, most of the people, most of the brands that use Damascus steel now, they are happy the minute they see a pattern appear. Mm-hmm. But I'm not happy with just a pattern. I want a three-dimensional effect, so I etch a lot harder. But
the pattern is there, but we can't see it yet. It hasn't been treated. So, and that's the same crown.
That's the same crown. And that's been etched and slightly polished once more.
So the grooves in the crown, are you doing them on the Bergeon 50?
No, I do the markings on the Bergeon, and then I do the
all by hand.
They are hand filed.
Okay. Wow.
But the basic shape of the crown is done on the Bergeon. Mm. And that's done by hand as well.
But that's a beautiful thing. That's also reminiscent of the hilt, or the top of a Viking longsword. Yeah.
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 That's a development of the Sarek crown I made, and we got the shapes from a Viking longsword hilt, the guard from a longsword.
Amazing.
To use for the shapes of the crown.
And that is the crown that goes on your new Skadi.
Yeah. And for that watch, I do an additional treatment here in Linköping to get the result which we call Black Damascus.
On the hands, on the case, etc., and the crown.
No, the case and crown. So the case and crown are in stainless Damascus steel, but it's been treated by a local company to get a very, very deep black tone.
It's astonishing, isn't it?
What do you mean a local company? Why did you have to go outside to do a certain type of treatment?
Well, I don't have the tools to do PVD treatment. It requires a lot of
it's PVD.
It's a kind of PVD treatment.
Okay, I got you. And what about the sub-second hand? Well, not a hand, but the
single. That's we have two logos, the GOS logo and also the Triskele, the three-legged hands. It's our version of a Viking symbol, Odin symbol.
So how are you making that?
Those are, I think, these hands were originally cut from a wire cutter. But nowadays, I would use my CNC.
What about the sub-second?
Yeah, it was also made from a wire cutter. And then everything after that was hand finishing.
I don't have a closer up view of the Triskele, but it might be. There's actually one on. I want to stay with the Skadi because, again, you have evolved what you've done, and you're now. That's a mother of pearl dial.
Yeah.
But it has a secret, and that becomes apparent when the lights go down.
Exactly.
So you have this ice cool.
You know, I'm. That's one of the things that are good with being able to be creative with other things than on the movement. I can do things like this. I got the idea to do both coloring and background lighting of Mother of Pearl through use of modern Superluminova.
Yeah.
So
it's absolutely beautiful. I think it's I love watching the evolution of GOS.
I don't think people caught that, Patrick, because that's wizard stuff.
Do you want to see it again?
Mother of Pearl is how are you lighting Mother of Pearl? It's a solid. It's a piece of pearl. Think about it.
Yeah, but it's so thin. Mm-hmm. It's so thin.
Don't tell people the trick, Patrick. It's wizardry. I knew that, but don't tell people, Patrick.
It's late, mate.
It's too late. It's too late then. But the dial is actually three layers of three different materials. Mother of pearl on the top and brass on the back as like a base.
Yeah,
dial, and then the Superluminova in behind,
sandwiched
in between. Wow. Yeah, it's a sandwich, but it has to be made. Of course, it took me a while to develop this. So even like it's the same thing with Johan's coloring. Of course, this can be copied, but I have actually a design protection for this dial. Yeah. So in Europe, at least.
Yeah, but it is just it's. Yeah, I was really looking forward to showing this here. So
beautiful. Absolutely beautiful.
Isn't it? Yeah. So
that's killer, man. Killer. So,
yeah. There is Joe in holy moly. I agree with you, Joe. I agree with you. And
so it's so fun because everything you saw on that watch is hand finished and made in Linköping, basically.
Yeah.
So what, what you were saying earlier is very transcending, and we speak about this with just everybody that me and Johnny talk to. Is all watchmakers go to watchmaking school, and they might even have one mindset before they got there. Oh, I'm going to do this, or this is what I want to do. And then they leave watchmaking school and they try this, they try that. They're getting experiences like I discussed before. But in the end, we need to find our own pathway that fits our own soul.
Yeah.
When we grew up before returning to that country, other watchmakers leave their country and because they found something else somewhere else. And there's many, many little pathways and ways we can go to use the knowledge that we gained in watchmaking school. Patrick found it. Patrick found this. He keeps telling you that. He doesn't want to sit there and work on hairsprings all day. That's not his gig, right? So there's no right or no wrong. And in independent watchmaking, all of us look at each one of people like Patrick, and we're real happy when we see someone like him because he's as happy as can be. He can do what he does all day long, you know, because it's not a job to him. That's his art. My way is a little bit different. I may not want to do this part or that part. The guy in Japan, he likes to do this and work with other people. He likes people.
Right.
And there's so many facets of watchmaking. It's so interesting. So
yeah.
There are so many facets to watchmaking. And, you know, if everybody did it the same way, we wouldn't have this variety, this spectrum of amazing designs and concepts. And
right,
I just love it. Some
people like to be locked up alone in one room, like Patrick is, and doing his thing, and other people like to be locked up in their room alone, like me, and do my other people want some helpers, and they can deal with other humans. A lot of watchmakers don't like other humans, just so
you know, I can deal with other humans.
Yeah, you sure can, absolutely.
So if that fits you, this is the moral of my story. I'm not trying to brown those Patrick or anybody. If you're interested in watchmaking and actually sitting at the bench or going to school, I want you to know that there is many avenues. Don't think you just got to fix a watch. It's a beautiful, beautiful thing to fall into for you.
And I can give a shout out to the Swedish watchmaking school because they have actually made a brilliant acquisition, as they say in sports. One of the best finishers and high-end watchmakers in the world, a Swedish guy, has decided to return back to Sweden and work at the watchmaker schools.
Oh, wow.
Klaus-Henrik Peel. He is a brilliant guy. Okay. Brilliant watchmaker, and his finishing is maybe McGonagall's are the ones who can.
Wow.
They're on the same level, in my opinion.
Wow.
So he will teach at the Swedish watchmaking school, and I'm really envious.
Yeah, you might want to go back to school for a couple months.
Yeah.
I know that's how I'd be thinking.
Yeah, for sure. So we've hit our kind of traditional closing time here of around about 90 minutes, and but Patrick, I have to say, I honestly could go on and talk about this for hours longer because it has been an absolutely fantastic journey through what you've been doing. And it's something that I've wanted to do for a long time because I fell in love with your watches when I saw them. I think I met Johan and yourself. It might have been in Basel many years ago in one of those little rooms.
Yeah, I think it was when we exhibited in the palace.
In the palace, and
good old days.
Yeah, good old days.
Before we sign off, we didn't ask Patrick the normal question we ask everyone about what music he listens to. Do you blast what do you blast in the workshop? Are you in silence? Is he a metalhead? We should start off like that. We always end. I'm sleeping by this time.
I can listen to just about anything, except for techno. I didn't listen to metal until my son brought me into that. He brought me into Korn and a lot of weird stuff. Mm-hmm. But I grew up listening to. My music taste is very odd, really. But I grew up listening to music from the 60s, and then I turned into progressive rock from England, The Police, Madness, and then I turned my eyes into funk, fusion, but nowadays I can't stand fusion. I listen to a lot of jazz, soul. So I think for the last 2 years, there's been a lot of soul music in the US workshop.
Do you listen to music while you work in the workshop?
Yeah. Mm. Almost always. I found some it's easier for me to work if it's not too groovy.
In your face, yeah.
Because as you might know, I'm a drummer as well, so it's easy for me to get going when I feel the groove. So I found it better to be a bit softer music, but I always have music on when I work.
It's the same with me. Yeah, I have music on from I start in the morning until I go to bed at night, and I used to listen to talk radio a lot. That started to fry my brain, and it did. You couldn't listen to it nowadays. So I have music on, and I'm hugely diverse taste as well. I like my rock. I like a bit of prog as well, as you say. Brilliant band I'm loving at the minute is Urbag, who are Norwegian, I think. Yeah, and Bjorn Riis. Who is her guitarist? He's a bit like Gilmore on a Les Paul.
That's Pink Floyd, of course.
Yeah.
I used to play in a 70s cover band.
Right.
20, 25 years ago. And so I listened to that a lot during that period. But since I started to play in a soul and funk band, I've changed to what I listen to. Because I like to listen to music I'm going to play. So I use that for practice as well.
Yeah, amazing. Brilliant. Listen, we have had such a good time tonight. Dan, I can't believe it. This was such an insight into a fantastic brand, a small brand that has its own struggles trying to get its name out there in the world and get people to understand it and get to get what GOS is, how it identifies. And I think, Patrick, you have given us such a fantastic insight out there tonight to have a look at your processes, your amazing material. We've got to also send our very best regards to Mr. Gustafsson as well. So Johan, if Johan is watching,
he is a metalhead.
I knew it. We should send his email.
How can he not be?
For sure, he was at one of my shows somewhere along the line.
I'm sure he has.
What a guy! So it's been fantastic having you on there tonight. So listen to stay about for a moment after we wrap up.
Well, Patrick, I just want to say that thank you very much for being on In the Metal. It's been a blessing to both me and Johnny, and you are representing your country wonderfully. Hopefully the people will see through this and other interviews that you do that you are not just representing your country, but representing independent watchmaking in your country done correctly. From the human heart, from your human heart, from the collaborative effort, and breaking new grounds, which is the most important part of being independent and showing what we are as artists, because that's what we are.
Yeah.
We're artisans who just happen to put time on your wrist.
Yeah. Okay?
That's what we are. And that's
right.
Hopefully, Patrick, you agree with that. But that is buy his product before he doubles and triples his prices, because as soon as more people find out, Tack it up, bro.
Yeah, everybody, thank you everyone for joining us again on another installment of In the Metal. I cannot tell you how much fun it is to do it. There's a lot of work involved in getting to doing this every Thursday night, but it is so rewarding to have a look at because we can't travel this year, we can't see these watches in person, so what better way of bringing them to you and hopefully raising awareness of these incredible independent watch brands. And so, folks, that was Patrick Sjogren from Gustafsson and Sjogren and In the Metal tonight. Let's do this again sometime, Patrick. But for now, thank you, everyone, for joining us. And we will see you next time on In the Metal.